Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. We are 2 minutes late. That's because I live in France. So I got Latinized. Sometimes my colleague wonder when I arrive after them. He overdoes it. The Germans overdo it. Why can't they just be late 10 minutes as everybody else? So I come 15 minutes late. And I come, so this is the academic quarter in Germany. So you have a 2 minute lateness to endure. Our subject this afternoon is the place of finance and financial markets in a free society. Financial markets have been much to the forefront of the attention of citizens, journalists, and also academics in the past few years in the context of the Great Recession, as it has been called, and the crisis of the financial markets that just won't go away. Financial markets have become increasingly important in the course of the past 30 or 40 years. We have some spectacular growth in the size of financial market intermediaries, much more so than in the previous decades. And there have been entirely new segments of financial markets that have increased much beyond imagination. For example, the so-called derivative markets, on which options, futures, swaps, and other sexy things are being exchanged, have grown from less than $1 billion in the 1980s to more than $700 trillion today. Okay, $700 trillion, just to give you some term of comparison, U.S. GDP, which of course is a flow, right? So it's not a stock variable, it's a flow variable. U.S. GDP is around $7 trillion today. All right, so we have just the derivatives markets of $700 trillion. This is enormous. Then invariably the question arises, what does this mean? What is the significance of such markets in society? Are they useful? Are they sort of an atomic bomb, right? One famous investor, Warren Buffett, as once called them, as financial weapon of mass destruction, right? The derivative markets. But even financial markets in general, even if we abstract from derivative markets, have grown to an astonishing size, right? So worldwide stock markets are in excess of $70 trillion, okay? And worldwide credit markets are about four times this amount. If we just look at the official markets, so the official stock market, the regulated stock markets, the regulated bond markets, and so on, we get only a tiny picture or tiny part of the whole picture. Most financial markets today are unregulated, ostensibly unregulated. They are the so-called OTC markets, the over-the-counter markets, and represent about three or four times the volume of the regulated markets. So all of this is source of concern. It seems to be a connection between financial markets and the current crisis. And according to a widespread hypothesis, financial markets, or the instability of financial markets, demonstrates that the market economy left to itself just cannot work, or at least it cannot work very well. I find the market economy is crisis-prone and therefore needs to be very strongly regulated. Unsurprisingly, therefore, financial markets are today not free markets. And this is a very essential point. Not free markets and have not been free markets for a very long time. In fact, even if we talk about the so-called unregulated markets, the OTC markets, it's true that the OTC exchanges per se are not regulated in most cases. But the agents that interact on these markets are mostly financial intermediaries, in particular banks and insurance companies. And these financial agents are very strongly regulated. In fact, probably financial markets are more strongly regulated than any sector of the economy, to the exception maybe of the so-called health sector, which is in fact the sector which tries its best to ruin our health. So we might dismiss the contention that the instability of financial markets demonstrates the unworkability of a truly free economy from the outset by just saying, well, in fact, they are not free. And in fact, this is the very first point that we should always raise. But this does not dispense us from careful analysis of the causal relationships that we find on financial markets. And this task has been somewhat neglected by economists. As a somewhat surprising contention maybe to make this, well, I will explain this in more detail. And it has also been neglected by Austrian economists. Most economists focus on so-called product markets. That is, they study the causal relationships that come into play in the production of consumer goods, and then also in the production of capital goods, that is, the interrelations between consumer goods markets and factor markets. So this is the basic stock in trade of economists. And if you look at Murray Rothbard's Man, Economy, and State, for example, or also at Ludwig von Mises' book Human Action, you will find that their attention is mostly focused on problems immediately surrounding the product markets. And the same attention, the typical procedure in most texts that we find in macroeconomics, or mainstream macroeconomics. On the other hand, the wealth markets, that is, financial markets, real estate markets in particular, have been neglected both by mainstream economists, but also by Austrian economists. So they have been the center of attention to a special breed of economists, those economists who are doing finance. And the basic problem, one of the great problems that we have in today as economics, both in mainstream economics and also in Austrian economics, is that there is some disconnect between the analysis of product markets on the one hand and the analysis of the wealth markets on the other hand. Very few economists have tried to come up with an integrated view. And those few who have tried to do so usually have been strongly influenced by a Keynesian view of the economy. And that's, of course, a sure way to miss the essential points and to have and to come to the wrong conclusions. So part of my research of the past few years, essential part of my research of the past few years has been dedicated to fill this gap. And I've also encouraged some of my doctoral students to do this. So some of them have written very good doctoral dissertations on aspects related to these problems. What I will do today is to give some basic outlines, some basic analysis of the very first part of the analysis of financial markets, namely that part that is of a rather hypothetical nature and concerns the operation of finance and financial markets in a free society. If you look very carefully at the great economics texts, starting from the 18th century, for example, Condillac's Commerce and Government, but then also the great treatises by Jean-Baptiste Say, Frédéric Bastiat, Mises, Rothbard, etc., you will always find that economists typically, not only Austrian economists, typically in a first step analyze the operation of a free society, of a free market, and then in a second step analyze the impact that government interventions have on this natural working of social cooperation. And that's what we need to do also in the analysis of financial markets. So that's what I do in my works. But today we have only time for the very first part, which is dedicated to this very first part. Maybe next year, if they give me additional time for another lecture, I will get to the other stuff. Okay. A few words on readings. In the mainstream literature, there are some texts that are very informative concerning the institutions of financial markets. I mentioned here in particular a standard text is Frederick Mishkin's text on money and financial markets. Money banking and financial markets, I believe, is a very good book in the sense that it gives a complete overview of the main institutions that come into play in monetary policy and also in financial market institutions. There are other texts of a similar quality, so all of this is very good, but it's, of course, very fairly descriptive. That is, as far as the causal analysis is concerned, we do not get very far. And to the extent that there's any causal analysis at all, it is usually either written from a microeconomic perspective, that is from the perspective of individual banks or individual other market intermediaries, or if it, to the extent that it is somewhat macroeconomic, it is written from a Keynesian point of view. That is, it is based on the hypothesis that the more money you spend, the better it is. And then, of course, you fall very easily into the trap of thinking that the bigger financial markets are, the better it is. And so the more credit there is, well, the better it is because we can spend ever more money. And that, of course, is very contrary to what we have inherited from Adam Smith and the classical economists. I mean that the volume of spending per se is not related systematically to economic growth, to the creation of real economic goods, and which is also the basic or the center of what we find in Austrian macroeconomics. So most of these texts that we find in contemporary literature are useless to come to an overall assessment of financial markets. Very few texts are of any use. You can learn a lot about institutions. You can learn about what are banks, what are investment funds, what are the different types of investment funds, what's the regulatory environment, what are the different theories that come in, that are currently held, and hypotheses that are being tested by econometricians and so on. So this is all good and fine. But you do not come to anything that resembles a praxeology of financial markets. So we have a few texts that I should like to recommend to you. One classic publication is the book by Fritz Machlup, published for the first time in German in the early 1930s, translated and published in the early 1940s under the title The Stock Market, Credit and Capital Formation. Mises had a very high opinion of the German edition of this book. I never found any statement that he made about the English edition. The English edition had a much more Keynesian bent. I will say a few words about this later on. By and large, what Machlup does in this book is to discuss, it's a very lengthy and systematic discussion of one central contention that was very influential in the 1920s and sometimes also is still influential today, namely the contention that the financial markets absorb capital that could be available to be spent in the form of revenues to sustain ordinary people. Right? So the idea is we have all this money that is being spent on financial markets, right, and creates revenue and very high prices there, and is being absorbed, sucked out of the rest of the economy. Right, and therefore makes that the revenues in the rest of the economy are lower than they could be. So there would be, it would be useful to have political intervention that steers away some of these payments onto the factor markets, thereby creates revenues for working people and for firms. Right? And what Machlup does in his book is to demolish this thesis. And he shows that actually, if financial markets grow, they do not truly absorb any monetary capital. What they do at the limit is to slightly increase the cash hoarding that is necessary to perform the transaction that is to perform financial exchanges. So I won't go into more detail now, but this is the main contention. There are various weaknesses to this book. One of which is that Machlup sticks too closely to the analysis of the spending streams. It's very much alike, for those of you who are interested in the history of economic thought, to the book of Richard Cantillon, right, that has been mentioned a couple of times already at this conference, The Nature of Commerce in General, so written at the beginning of the 18th century, in which Cantillon analyzes the distributional effects of money spending, among other things. And he does this by tracing back spending streams. Who spends what? So this creates revenue for other people. How do they spend then the money and so on? So he retraces the circuit. Machlup does by and large the same thing, follows the same approach. And this is all good and well to some extent, but of course you can miss some very essential points about which I will talk later on. Then there are two texts being published by non-Austrians in the beginning of the 1930s, which I should like to point out because they're very useful to understand our current problems that we have on financial markets. Ronald McKinnon and Edward Shaw were analyzing the negative consequences of financial repression. Okay. That is, the negative consequences of government interventionism on financial markets. And they demonstrated, well, that because governments intervened massively in the financial markets in order to steer wealth into the hands of the government, they discouraged savings and thereby also discouraged production. Now, it's a very short summary of what they did, and I do not want to endorse everything that was in their book. It has a very strong Keynesian general orientation, right? But it's, what is interesting in the book, especially the opening chapters in which they describe the various techniques for financial repression, and they are interesting in our own day because we are increasingly turning in the Western countries, toward a situation in which at the beginning of the 1930s, 70s, only banana republics could found themselves, right? A situation of financial repression in which the government controls all wealth and thereby destroys the operation of the market economy. And so this is a very useful reading for us today. Then, in a shameless attempt of self-promotion, three of my own texts. So one is a book, Krise der Inflationskultur, so a German text has been published last year. An English translation has already been made, and I need to revise this now and hope it will be forthcoming early next year in a revised and extended English edition. So here is then a first a statement of the work that I've been carrying on in the past few years, just a summary statement of the political economy of finance. How is the economy being financed in the absence of government intervention? How is wealth being used in the absence of government intervention? And how does government intervention, in particular fiat money, how does this change the way savings are being made, savings are being invested, savings are being used? I have produced as a spin-off two texts in two working papers in English, which you can find very easily by just typing the titles in Google or any other search machine. The first one is Fiat Money and the Distribution of Incomes and Wealth, which I address a topic of current interest. That is, I addressed it already before it became of current interest, which is under the impact of Thomas Piketty's book, Capitalism in the 21st Century, right? So then there's great interest in the issue of distribution. And what I explain in this working paper is that, in fact, the big distributional impact comes from the institution of fiat money. And so we get an increasing wedge between incomes, but also between incomes and wealth, and between the wealth of different individuals as a consequence of a fiat money system. And the third paper, which I've written for a colloquium that was held last year in Italy, deals with financial markets and the production of law. The title is somewhat confusing, but what I do in the paper is to draw the analogies between government intervention in financial markets and government intervention in the production of law. The colloquium at which this paper was presented was in honor of Bruno Leoni, the famous Italian legal philosopher, who was the first, actually, to analyze the economics of lawmaking. So he was original as compared to, he went beyond Mises in pointing out, well, that economics can also be applied to analyze the production of law. And he pointed out how government interventionism, in particular, the excessive use of legislation, so of statutory law, distorts and perverts the production of law. So law becomes of a worse quality and is becomes contrary to its very objective through government interventionism. And I point out that the same thing can be said on account of financial markets. Financial markets, under the impact of government interventionism, are perverted and eventually turn out results contrary to their nature. Okay, so in what follows, I will first discuss the meaning of finance in general. I will take a broad approach. And then I'll discuss the three main forms of finance in a free society. And finally, discuss the benefits and costs of financial markets. Okay, so we'll start off with the definition. It's always useful to start off with the definition. And to finance means, or the verb to finance means to provide the means necessary to accomplish a human activity. That's the most general definition that I propose for the meaning of finance. We find here also the etymological root of the word finance. Finance comes from the Latin verb finare, and is similar also to the French verb finir, and medieval French finir, which means to finish, to bring to an end. We can start all kinds of things, but we cannot bring to an end everything. We can bring our activities to an end only if we have the means to accomplish it. And the most basic means that we need, of course, is time. Right? We need to have time to finish the things that we start. Now, this sounds silly, but of course, if it's an activity only like giving a lecture or something like this, so we are done very soon, there's no problem, because my stomach is full and, right, and, happy as enough oxygen here in this room and whatever, so probably we'll get to the end, so no question, right? But there are various other things, if you think of it, that of course are problematic, right? Do we have all the means to go to bring the activity really to an end? And of course, we know this problem. We know that this can be a macroeconomic problem from Austrian business cycle theory. What Austrian business cycle theory tells us is that if entrepreneurial judgment is distorted by interest rates that are artificially low, then they are likely to start too many projects that cannot all be finished. We start too many things, then we lack the real means to carry them out. That's an Austrian business cycle theory, it's the 30-second version. So if I say, well, most basically we need the time to finish, what do I mean? Well, most basically to finance means to provide the consumer goods necessary to sustain human activity during the time needed to carry or to complete this activity. Time itself just goes on. We don't need to finance time. What we need to finance is our own consumption. Human beings operate under the constraint of the stomach. Right? We are not purely spiritual beings, right? Angels, right? Perfect beings, perfectly spiritual beings, know the future and the present, know everything. So like the Nietzschean perfect competition beings, right? But angels wouldn't need finance, because they don't need to eat. Very simple. So finance is an eminently human phenomenon. It's because we are earthly beings, we are physical beings that need to be sustained by consumption, therefore we need finance. It's the most basic, most original meaning of finance, to provide consumer goods. And this insight was first developed by Richard von Strigel. I think we have... only one of his books has been translated into English, Capital and Production. I think we have it on sale in our library. Have a look at it. If not, please don't steal any copies that we have here, but make the suggestion that they produce some new. It's a great work on Austrian capital theory, and Strigel stressed this point, right? That finance means, the original meaning of finance is to provide consumer goods. So those things that need to, or those activities that need to be financed particularly, are those activities that do not themselves produce consumer goods. If you are working in an orchard, so you're picking berries or apples or pears, and at the end of the day, or in fact any minute, right? Through your activity, you produce foodstuff that you can use to sustain your own activity. There's no problem there. It's very different if we produce something like, say, like a microphone or like a car or like a street, right? The person who are engaged in building a road. Okay, you cannot, well, okay, maybe you can sleep on the road, but it doesn't protect you from rain falling down, right? It doesn't protect you from the wind. It does not give you a shelter to your body. You cannot eat it. At least you shouldn't try. And so on, right? So the people engaged in the production of a capital good need finance. It's not possible to do it otherwise, right? Because what we need to do is to finance their consumption. The question is, so where do these means come from, right? So the real financial means, right? It's not sufficient just to produce more money. Of course, we see immediately we cannot eat money. Right? If we have money, it helps us to buy things that already exist, right? But we cannot maintain consumption just by printing more tickets. So where does the real means come from that we need to accomplish our activities? Well, they can only come from previous production. There's no other source possible. So it means that in the past, and the past can mean the past hour, the previous day, the previous week, the previous year, in the past, at some point of time, we must have produced in excess of current consumption. To consume means what? What does it mean to consume? To use up, okay. Even more strongly? Definitely gone, yes. Even more strongly? To destroy. Thank you, sir. To consume means to destroy. The economist who stressed this most strongly was Karl Marx. One of the few points on which he was right. To consume means to destroy. And one of my good old German fellow Austrians, Roland Bader, is a great economist who died a few years ago. He always said, well, that's the most basic refutation of Keynesian economics. You cannot grow rich by consumption. You cannot grow rich by destroying things. The only way to grow rich is to save and to accumulate. It's the only way. Right. To consume means to destroy. Some things are destroyed right away. Right? And destruction, of course, does not mean physical evaporation, but it means physical transformation into a state of affairs that is for human beings of no value or of lesser value than what we had before. Right? It's most clear in the case of foodstuff, and so we transform this through our bodies and so on into a state that I do not need to describe, which is of no value for us so far, unless an insightful entrepreneur comes and turns this into a gold mine, we'll see. And other things we destroy more slowly, more gradually. For example, if we build a nice house and so on, right, then we have a long-term consumer goods that is destroyed at a very low rate, but it's destroyed nevertheless. Okay. So only human activities need to be financed. Nothing else, strictly speaking, needs to be financed. We do not need to finance machines. We do not need to finance cars. We do not need to finance houses. Now, that sounds exaggerated, but it is true. Right? The car itself does not need to be financed. The house does not need to be financed. What we do need to finance is the consumption of the people who built the house. That's what we really do. So if we go to a bank, we ask for a credit or something like that, or if we save and accumulate our monetary revenue and then pay for the car, what we really finance is the consumption of the people who built the car or who built the house. It's not the car itself, and it's not the house itself.
What about animals? If you produce milk, for instance, you have to finance the cow to sustain life.
Yeah. Or yeah, that's correct. Yeah.
So not only humans.
Yeah, also animals. Very good point. Yeah. But essentially, right, then there are two, right? You also need to finance not only the cow, but also the consumption of the owner of the cow. Yeah. But you're right, right? So what are the different forms then finance can take in the context of a free society? essentially, there are three main forms. I think, right away. First main form is self-finance. What's the main source of finance of companies? Of any firm? Income. Thank you. Right? It's typically wrong. I always ask this in my classes and so on. One of the first answers that I get is always, bank credit. Wrong. Right? Okay, in some cases it's true, right? But in the aggregate, if we look at most firms, we say, what's their main source of finance? Always revenue. It's always money income, gross money income, resulting from the sale of products and services. Okay. The same thing for a household. What's the main source of finance for a household? Well, in the aggregate, it's always revenue, right? And for young houses, slightly different. I'll come to talk to about this maybe a little later. Right. So we have revenue coming through the sale of services and products that we create. Now let's remain here for just a second and think about this. So what? How does this relate now to the concepts of saving and consumption that we discussed before? Let's say you have a company. You sell whatever bookshelves. A big company, you sell a lot of bookshelves. And let's say you have a gross annual revenue of $1.2 million. So this is the revenue of the company. It's the gross revenue. It's the turnover. And now you, in any year, you reinvest. That's how we put it usually. We reinvest, let's say, $1 million. So we exchange. Out of the 1.2 million of our revenue, we take 1 million and exchange that million for the services provided by our employees and by our suppliers. And people who deliver wood to us, and the people who work for us, and the marketing, finance, and so on, but also at the saw and so on, and fabricating the shelves and so on. Right. So that amount that is so-called being reinvested, it's that amount that is in fact being saved by the owners of the firm. We use a different vocabulary as reinvestment, but in fact, that reinvestment is nothing else but money that is being saved by the owner of the company and then invested. Or in fact, it's one act, right? It's saved, invested. And the saving occurs in the form of that investment. The owner could spend every single penny of the 1.2 million of gross revenue into his own consumption. So if he chooses not to spend it on his own consumption, but only spends 200,000 on his own consumption, it means that the rest is not so spent on consumption. And by definition, then, this is the savings generated within that firm. And savings generated in this way, and so reinvested typically in the same firm, not always, but typically reinvested in the same firm, are the most important form of finance of companies in a developed market economy. Now, if we only had self-finance, and also we find this same procedure also in McKinnon and in Shaw, the two texts that I highlighted before, right? If we only had self-finance, then of course the economy would not be very efficient in many ways, right? Only people who had savings and had already firms that generated large income could produce any significant amount of savings. For all others, it would take a long while to build up savings and to build up their own companies. Right? So therefore, interpersonal finance is a very important aspect of a market economy, an essential aspect, in fact. So that we use the savings of person A to finance the activities of person B. Now, the crucial thing that needs to be stressed from an Austrian point of view, which is not stressed in Makro, which is not stressed in any of the other contemporary texts on financial markets, is that financial markets are not the only way to do this. The tested hypothesis in Makro and in Mishkin and any other financial market theorist today is that only financial markets allow for interpersonal finance. The only way to use the savings of person A to finance the activities of person B is through a transfer or financial exchange between A and B. And of course, if this were so, then clearly financial markets would be an unavoidable, fundamental, necessary, vital element of society. Could not do without financial markets at all. But the truth is that there is another way to generate interpersonal finance, and this, surprisingly, is cash hoarding. You generate revenue, and rather than put this money that you do not use for current spending on consumer goods, rather than keeping it on your bank account or buying a life insurance policy or putting it in an investment fund or 401k account, you just keep it in your pocket. Or you bury it into the ground in your garden and hide it. It's not a good idea in the case of banknotes, right? Federal Reserve notes, euro notes. Not a good idea. I do not recommend this. But let's say you did, right? The error consists in thinking that, well, the story stops us there. What you're doing is just to suck the blood out of the economy. It's the Keynesian view, right? You're taking money out of circulation, and so you're paralyzing the rest of the economy. And anyway, this is just for you. It's a very selfish way of saving, because you're doing it just for yourself. It's like if you take, so you have your sheep, right? You're a shepherd, and you have your sheep, and you never sell them. You just keep them in your own farm, and so you look at them, you're happy, and so on. You never share the meat and the wool, and so on. That's just a very selfish way of producing things just for yourself. But the truth is that once we save in the form of cash, we invariably start financing the activities of other people. Because saving in cash results invariably in a reduction of the price level. If we take money out of circulation, so to say, so there's less money that is being exchanged for all other goods, so money becomes scarcer relative to these other goods, so money prices start to fall. Now, what this means is that those money units that are still being exchanged, that are not being hoarded, have a higher purchasing power. And consumers who still exchange their money can buy more consumer goods. Investors who still exchange their money for factors of production can buy more factors of production. Thus, in fact, it is as if we had given a credit, a consumer loan to a consumer, or as if we had given a producer's loan to a firm, or as if we had bought stock on a primary market from a firm. We allow those other people to control more real resources than they would have been able to do without our saving. This is an absolutely fundamental point. And it's, from a political point of view, it's so important because saving in cash has always been, and to the present day, the preferred form of saving of low-income families. It was a long cultural evolution starting in the 19th century that brought people away from saving in cash and starting to invest in life insurance and so on. And even to the present day, very few really low-income families buy any financial products. Most of them have their money on the bank account, and that's all that they have, is all the savings that they have. The tragedy today is that, of course, as we know, this money that is on the bank account just evaporates under the impact of price inflation, which was not the case in the glorious days of the 19th century, in which workers were so cruelly exploited, according to the Marxists, but at least their savings that they had in the form of gold coins or silver coins, which they kept under the pillow or in a hole dug into their garden, preserved its purchasing power and even appreciated. So today, of course, saving in cash is no longer a rational investment strategy. It's no longer a rational way of saving, of investment, because the purchasing power of money evaporates. So this form of saving plays no more role today. But it can play a role in a free society. And if we had a truly free market economy with natural money such as gold and silver, in which there would be a deflationary price, deflationary tendency, right? Money prices would tend to diminish year after year, so the purchasing power of money would tend to increase. Well, this would be a very strong and very important form of saving. People would save in the form of cash hoarding much more than they do today. Then, of course, the Keynesians say, but this is terrible. You just admitted it. Well, this is the vampire economy, strangulating. Right? It's normal. All the blood is being sucked out of the circulation. We are all vanishing and so on. So next day we'll be dead, right? And of course, so the point of Austrian economics is to explain that this fear is, of course, unfounded, right? The entrepreneurship can occur very well in an environment in which prices decrease, right? Until 2 years ago, I always had a lecture on deflation, the economics of deflation. Now you need to watch this on the internet. Glorious old days. But I also have a book on deflation and liberty. You might have a look at this. Right? So deflation is not a problem for a market economy. It's a natural part of a free society. In a free society in which there were no government intervention, in particular, no monetary interventionism, prices would tend to fall. And this fall of money prices would be reinforced by the fact that this would generate more savings in the form of cash hoardings. Yes, it would be accelerated, but it would not be a spiral. It would not get spiraled out of control. Right? It would be slightly higher than it would otherwise be. But there's no problem for production. Okay. The third form of savings, of finance, occurs through financial markets. So what is a financial market? A financial market is a financial exchange. What is a financial exchange? Yes, okay, that's an example. Could you give a general definition? What do I buy? Right. Okay. Yeah. So that's what you do. But right away when you, let's say you buy a stock, what do you buy?
Do you exchange the present good for claim on a future good?
Say it again.
Company's assets.
Company's assets. Okay.
A present good for a claim on a future good.
For present consumption, for later consumption?
Yeah, okay, yeah. Okay, I'll give you my definition. Right? It was all somewhat correct. Right? It's all somewhat correct. But what happens, in fact, if we make a financial investment, we buy something. Of course, ultimately, we want to attain what you just described, higher future consumption and so on. Yeah? But at the very moment when we execute the financial exchange, we buy a promise of a future payment. That's what we do. If I lend you money, and you say, tomorrow I'll pay back. Well, then, in fact, I buy your promise. If it's just oral, well, it's nothing that I even hold in my hand. It's just my memory and so on. But, right, if we have a financial market, then usually you get some piece of paper. But ultimately, it's just a piece of paper on which you write, I promise to. Right? Even if you buy a stock, right, and you say, well, I promise that you will share in the dividends that we will pay next year and in the future years and so on. I promise that your voice will count at the general meeting of the shareholders that we hold once a year. I promise, et cetera, et cetera. You buy a promise. And sometimes that's not worth very much. Right? But we are free to buy a promise or not. Right? Therefore, also, we have very special types of promises which go ahead with a lot of guarantees, right, oversight and so on. These are then called securities. So I'll spare you the details, right? This is a security. It's a promise that is secured by various institutions, such as oversight and so on. So on a market, a financial market, we exchange present money, so our savings, for a promise of future monetary payments. It is instructive to compare a financial exchange with finance in the form of cash hoarding. From a macroeconomic view, that is, from an overall economic view, both have the same effects, right? Both transfer real resources from a saver to other persons. If I save in cash, well, prices will diminish so other people can buy more, right? I finance their activity through my savings. If I buy a corporate bond, right, I transfer my savings to the firm, and the firm can then use my savings to acquire more things than they otherwise could. Right? So in that respect, there's no difference, right? The basic function is the same. The trend is interpersonal finance in both cases. The difference concerns most notably two related points. The first and fundamental one is that in the case of financial markets, I can pick the beneficiaries. And if I hoard my money, my savings in cash, I do not know who will be the beneficiaries. Right? And of course, if I save just $100, I mean, the impact will be so small that it's barely noticeable. Right? But let's say I save a huge amount, even then $1 billion or $1 trillion. It's difficult to say who will benefit to what extent. It's certainly not up to me to decide who will benefit to which extent. It depends on various things. It depends on all market participants. Right? Some prices will diminish more, others less. Some prices will diminish earlier, others later. Right? So we cannot pick the beneficiaries. In the case of a financial exchange, I do pick the beneficiary. Right? So I can say, I want to promote this activity. It's not necessarily something that aims at profit. I can finance a firm. Not necessarily. I might finance our government. Please do not. But I could, right? I can finance a charitable institution. I can finance friends, relatives, and so on. Right? So I pick the beneficiary. And because I can pick the beneficiary, I can also, of course, start to make a deal. I can say, okay, you will restitute the sum that I provided to you, plus a little extra. Right? So, which, of course, is what we call, well, the revenue, the interest rate, right, or the gross profit, so on, resulting from the financial exchange. Right? So, in other words, I can start to derive a revenue from a financial exchange, which I cannot if I save in the form of cash. And that, ladies and gentlemen, is, of course, the foundation for what we might call, in any case, what I have called, the financial division of labor. It's the financial division of labor. In the division of labor, we specialize in activities that we pursue in excess of our own personal needs. As a shoemaker, I make more shoes than I need for myself and my family, and I exchange the surplus against other things produced by other specialists. In finance, the financial division of labor, I start saving more than I would need just to finance my own activities, my own immediate projects, in order to derive a revenue from that. If I have no difficulties living a frugal life, this is a great way to earn additional revenue. Right? I just save more and it creates me revenue on top of what I earn by my daily activities. So financial markets have this great advantage, or hold this great promise at least, right? That they provide incentives to save in excess of each individual's own needs for savings, right? Immediate direct needs for savings. If it were not financial markets, only one group of persons would save for the immediate benefit of other persons. Which group is that? How do we call these persons? No, not hares. So one group of persons that saves for the immediate benefit of other persons. Thank you, sir. Capitalist entrepreneurs. Capital entrepreneurs save and invest in order to produce things that they do not use themselves. Right? So you have a car company, you produce hundreds of thousands and millions of cars. How many of those cars do you use yourself? A few. Right? So it's all for the other guys. And of course, you do this because you expect that you will get revenue out of this in excess of your previous investment. So ultimately, you do it for your own benefit. But you save for the immediate benefit of other persons. If it were not for financial markets, only capitalist entrepreneurs who self-finance their own activities would do this. So only thanks to financial markets Right? This division of labor becomes generalized. Now, suddenly, more or less all persons may engage in that division of labor, irrespective of their daytime activities, whether they be a carpenter or a construction worker or a professor and so on. Everybody can partake in the financial division of labor, start saving for the immediate benefit of other persons, and to the ultimate benefit, then, hopefully, of oneself. So that's the main advantage of financial markets. They allow for financial division of labor and thereby increase the amount of savings beyond what would occur in the absence of financial markets. Right? At this point, you look for it desperately and in vain in current mainstream literature. One is never made. Why is it never made? Well, because most of today's writings on financial markets is based on the Keynesian foundation. And of course, for Keynes, as soon as you say that savings increase, then your hands start to shake and the blood disappears out of your veins and so on. Say, that seems to be very bad. Right? So according to the standard view today, what financial markets do is something different. They concentrate savings. Right? They do not create a tendency for more savings to occur, therefore less consumer spending, which would be very, very bad. Right? But they concentrate savings. Right? What banks do, according to the mainstream view, is that the banks take all this money that would lie idle in cash hoards, in people at home and so on. And so they get the people to congregate this money in the bank accounts, and the bank can make a nice big loan to somebody else. Right? No reduction of consumer spending, but an increase of investment spending. Win-win. Right? Of course, to some extent, it's correct, right? Financial markets, the presence of financial markets is likely to reduce cash hoarding, so that's correct. So there's more spending going on investment goods. But as I've just explained, they're also likely to reduce consumer spending. And as Austrian economists, we're not at a nervous face-to-face with this fact. But of course, from a Keynesian view, this would be suicidal, right? We do not want financial markets to do that. We want that everything goes on as before. So what are the offs of financial markets? So these are the benefits, or it's the main benefits. What are the disadvantages of financial markets? Well, the big disadvantage is, of course, that you entrust your savings to somebody else. Right? So in the jargon of today's economics, we have an agency problem. Right? Some other guy there, can we trust this other person? If it's the government, yes. If it's whatever. Bank XZ, I don't name any names now. Yes. But also very mean people. There are hedge funds and firms located or based in the Cayman Islands and something like that. Oh, no, this is very bad, very bad. Yeah, so we need to watch this, right? We have an agency problem. Right, so basic agency problem is, well, you don't know, in fact, whether you can trust this person, you can go wrong, and so on. This is the basic, so this is the trade-off that you make in performing in a financial exchange rather than hoard in the form of cash. Right. So in a free society, then, we have an equilibrium somewhere, right, between the different ways of using wealth, different ways of using our savings. Some of the savings are used in our own projects. Some of the savings are held in cash. Other savings are exchanged for promises of future payments. And of course, there's a great number of different promises that we can buy. Right? So there is an equilibrium somewhere that depends on the subjective assessment of each individual. Somewhere. So financial markets would play a significant role in a free society, but they would not play a predominant role. We would rather have to assume that cash hoarding would be much more important than it is today, possibly more important than all the money that is being exchanged through financial markets. Possibly. We don't know. We'd have to let the market process operate in order to see. Right? And financial markets would not have an inbuilt tendency to grow and to have a spiraling exponential growth, right? Because there are, of course, decreasing returns on investment, just as in any other industry. Right? These things change under the impact of fiat money, most notably. So this is the big game changer, and this is what I explain in my book. And if you have a fiat money, the most important thing that happens, something that I already alluded to, namely that it's no longer worthwhile to invest anything in cash. If you keep your savings in cash, you're sure to lose each year at least 2 or 3% in the so-called hard money currency areas. Right? Everywhere else, you lose even much more. Right? So what do? If you can no longer save in cash, well, you have to choose, you have to pick an alternative. What are the alternatives? Well, there are by and large four alternatives. Okay, either you spend more money on real estate, or you buy more promises of future payments, or you spend more money on your firm, or you increase your spending on current consumption. Right? Most people are not entrepreneurs, so one alternative is irrelevant for 95% of humanity or 98%. Right? So there are just three possibilities that remain: more consumer spending, more exchanges against financial products, or more purchases of real estate markets, of real estate. Right? Of course, so what does this imply? Well, it implies that the absolute volume, the overall volume of savings are likely to decrease, right? Because some of the money that you would otherwise have saved will now be spent on consumer goods, so you save less. Right? So overall impoverishment, because the overall volume of saving diminishes. Right? And then you get various other distributional effects, such as, for example, that now the prices of wealth goods, such as real estate and financial titles, increases relative to the prices of products. That is, relative to the prices of factor incomes. Right? And that is, of course, it's a phenomenon that benefits those who are already rich, right, at the expense of those who are not yet rich or will never be rich. Right? It takes longer years to buy a house, longer years to save to eventually buy a house or to buy a car, etc. It takes more years to recover wealth that is being lost. People become more materialistic and so on. I will go into more detail about these cultural consequences in my last lecture at the end of the week, right? The cultural consequences of fiat money. So I've said the essential things. I mean, we might have 1 minute for questions.
Can the promises of future payment work as money?
Yeah, they can be secondary media of exchange. Right?
Do they need to be backed up by gold or something?
Not necessarily. Right? So we see this today. Right? So some exchanges can be settled with certain financial products. Sometimes real estate is being bought in exchange for government bonds and stuff like this. Oh, that's a different issue, right? So it's not necessarily related to free banking. You might have no free banking at all. You might have no fractional reserve banking at all, right? The important thing is that financial titles, especially in the current situation, are very liquid, so it's easy to exchange them. As a consequence, they are liable to be used in some cases as a secondary media of exchange. Not really money, but they can be used as media of exchange.
Is the purchase of commodities or land or things of that nature qualify as hoarding, or no, not really because money is exchanging?
Yeah, that's a good point. Yeah, there are very, very strong similarities there, right? Of course, in most cases, it's not really hoarding, right? Very few people start go around and buy just houses and then keep them empty, right? So in most cases, what you typically would do, you buy a bigger house for your family, right? Or a house at a nicer location. You spend more money on this. This is what typically happens. But sometimes it can also be an investment, right? So some, especially in France, I've seen this a lot. I suppose in the US it's similar. You have certain families who invest all their savings in real estate. So they buy apartments and so on, then rent them out to other people. Is a very rational strategy in an environment characterized by fiat money, because prices always go up, right? So you can expect the revenue coming out of the real estate to increase, plus you can expect the monetary value of the real estate itself to increase in the course of time. There was another question here.
Going back to the first question, however, those future promises are discounted, right? When you transfer your title.
Yeah, it's also financial exchange, right? Do you ask the grandma to sign an IOU?
Of course. Trust
each
other.
Okay, thank you for your attention.